versus EPA, Mr. Narayan.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Sanjay Narayan, appearing on behalf of the petitioners. We are here challenging the EPA's decision to issue a Clean Air Act permit for the Prairie State coal plant. Our first claim is that EPA applied the wrong standards when it refused to require low-sulfur coal as the best available control technology, or BACT, for the plant. The Clean Air Act tells EPA very specifically what to take into account when it decides whether to require an available pollution control method. It tells EPA to take into account energy, environmental, and economic impacts and other costs. Here, EPA's decision was based on very different factors. It based its decision on Prairie State's goals and objectives. That divergence between the statutory factors on the one hand and the basis of EPA's decision.
How far would you push this? I mean, suppose there wasn't any low sulfur coal in the United States, but we know nuclear power is cleaner. So could you say, well, they should use nuclear fuel instead of coal?
I think that would present a very different case for two reasons. One is that EPA has always understood the word available in available method systems and techniques of pollution control to include some consideration of technical feasibility. So there would be a question as to...
Consideration of technical what?
Of technical feasibility, that is whether or not...
Well, it's certainly feasible to build a nuclear plant.
It is, but here we know that this plant plans to and is capable of burning coals from other areas.
That depends on what this plant means. Yes, it as an emergency, in an emergency, it can burn other coal, but it's designed, you know, with this conveyor belt and so on, to be a mine mouth, you know, coal electric generating facility. So isn't there just a difference? Or take another case. Suppose in Europe they have coal burning electrical plants which are designed differently and as a result do not emit as much coal. Maybe it burns the coal at a higher temperature or something like that.
Well, there I think EPA would be faced with a question as to whether that was a production process within the meaning of the statutory terms. Production process, method, system,
yes,
or
technique. But look, the conveyor belt is part of the production process, right?
But here the statute specifically says that these terms, whatever they mean, include clean fuels.
Yeah, sure, so, but you didn't. But nuclear fuel is clean too, and yet you weren't willing to say that they might have to replace their coal burning plant with a nuclear plant.
I think from that perspective,
that's a clean fuel, right? So.
No, I think that EPA there would have a different argument that it doesn't have here. It could say, well, that's not a clean fuel. That's a completely different fuel. Congress has made it very clear that low-sulfur coal is a...
very semantic, right? What? Because you could say, well, low-sulfur coal is a very different fuel from high-sulfur.
But Congress has made very clear that it specifically intended, when it said clean fuels, it meant...
Well, nuclear fuel is clean fuel.
Well, it's a clean fuel, but again, I think that there's this distinction that EPA could draw that it hasn't drawn here between cleaner versions of the same fuel.
Coal which has no sulfur at all, some wonderful coal, no sulfur. But on the other hand, actually to burn it in an electric plant requires, you know, a redesign of the plant. So what would your position be in a case like that?
They would have to look at the costs and impacts of burning that coal. If it's conceded that it is a...
What you're saying is that even if a plant has to be redesigned in order to burn a clean fuel, it's, you know, it meets this first stage of the best available control technology statutory criterion.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is
I find that troublesome.
Well...
Because it opens up, you know, for you and the EPA to say, well, look, you know, you're burning this, you're burning that, you're burning the other thing, but if you redesigned your plant, you could burn potato chips, right? And you wouldn't emit any sulfur at all.
Now,
that's a clean fuel. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. Potatoes have sometimes been used as a fuel. Right, you can make gasoline from potatoes. So, where does your position carry us?
Well, I think the starting point of our position is that whatever line EPA draws, it has to draw that line with reference to the statutory text. All we need to know that low-sulfur coal was a pollution control technology that EPA had to consider, was that low-sulfur coal wasn't available clean fuel.
Look, that's not responsive. There are many clean fuels. And you can, in fact, anything that contains carbon, you can make, you can burn. You can, you know. So any organic material could be used as a fuel for an electric, you know, to heat water, to generate electricity. So you're saying that the EPA can identify some clean, very clean fuel, and then tell the power company, you have to redesign your plant to burn this fuel.
Well, what EPA has said in the past is that if it's a cleaner version of the same fuel, Congress put that design change on the table. I mean, every back condition involves a change in the design of a proposed facility. What the statute says is that whatever the applicant proposes...
Well, it's a matter of degree, how much of a change. Here, you know, they have this... They find this vein of coal, and they want to build a plant next to it so they can use a conveyor belt, which is a very different mode of transportation from carrying it by train from hundreds of miles away. And why isn't that conveyor belt part of the design?
Well, it is part of the design, but to the extent that all we're interrogating here is the fuel choice of the facility, Congress put that question on the table. Now, it may be that the presence of this adjacent mine has a strong effect on the costs and impacts of different fuel choices. It may be that it's simply not cost-effective.
The evidence that they picked this in order to avoid environmental regulations?
No, Your Honor. We don't have any evidence of malicious intent, but we do know that EPA never looked at the costs.
No, but why not this as a rule, which would say that if the design is not intended to beat environmental regulations, then the company doesn't have to redesign. It has to, you know, install scrubbers and this and that and the other thing, but it doesn't have to redesign its facility. Because, and you know, the redesign is very fundamental here. It's not just the conveyor belt, it's the location, right? They want to build this plant in this specified location because of the proximity of the coal. If they can't burn this coal, if they have to burn coal somewhere else, there's no reason for them to have their plant there. So you're really asking the EPA to say to them, look, move the plant, redesign the plant, forget about the conveyor belt, because there's a clean fuel somewhere in the United States.
Well, no, Your Honor. All we're asking them to do is to look at the cost of other fuels. Now, what EPA has said here is Prairie State owns this adjacent supply.
They have to look at the cost of relocating the plant.
Well, no, they can take the location of the plant as a given if they want to.
Why do you say they can take it, but Peabody doesn't take it as a given? I mean, suppose that the only reason the plant is here is the proximity of the high sulfur coal. And that if you tell them, no, you've got to consider this low-sulfur coal, they'd move away. So now the cost analysis expands. How much would it cost them to locate somewhere else, you know?
No, Your Honor, EPA can take the location of the plant as a given. It can take the location of the mine as a given. It can say Prairie State is going to build this mine right next to this plant and the plant right next to the mine. What it can't say is that we are simply going to ignore all other sources of fuel.
The reason they're putting this plant here is that they have a coal supply right there, right? So when EPA were to say, we got this cheap coal, you know, 1,000 miles away and so on, then they would come back and say, yes, that's fine, but this location where we've designed our... It only made sense because of the proximity of the high sulfur coal. So if you make us use the low sulfur coal, we're going to incur, you know, some substantial expense shifting, finding another location.
Well, then you look at the cost. Again, they don't have to find a new location. They could say, if we have the plant right here, here's how much coal from this mine next door costs. Here's how much low sulfur coal from, we don't know how far away, but some other distance costs.
So the EPA can say, well, move your plant.
No, it can't. It never has.
Why not?
Well, if it's, in fact,
what
cheaper.
What if the statute says that they can't say, pick another location?
I think the statute leaves EPA room to say that relocating, not building the plant, building it somewhere else, isn't fairly described as a method, system, or process of pollution control. But saying that a clean fuel, I mean, everyone here accepts that this is a clean fuel. Saying that that's not a method of pollution control runs right into the statutory language. And that's the move they've made here. Now, it could even be, for all we know, it could be cheaper. And it could be cheaper to bring in low sulfur coal. They never looked at the costs. Now, the statute does not allow Prairie State to burn whatever it wants. That's our central point. The fuel choice here is something that Congress has placed into question. And it's given the EPA very broad standards as to how it assesses that question. It gets to look at the costs. But if, in fact, it's cheaper to burn low-sulfur coal, what the Act says is, okay, if it's cost-effective, we wouldn't
have a case.
Well, we don't know.
In case if it was cheaper, they'd do it, right?
Well, we don't. EPA never looked. I mean,
why if low sulfur coal is cheaper, why would they be burning high sulfur coal?
Well, I don't know. It could be because they already bought the high sulfur coal. They already own it.
Well, what percentage of low sulfur coal would be needed to make a difference?
EPA never got to the question of what that would be. We know that low sulfur coal could reduce, I believe the record says, pollution down to by a factor of about 40%, but I don't quite remember. But they could mix it. I mean, any low-sulfur coal would make a difference. I mean, the less sulfur, the less sulfur dioxide. So it could be 5%. There's a question as to where the costs and benefits even out here.
And if there were a larger percentage of low-sulfur coal, would that change the facility's basic purpose?
The facility's basic purpose? Yeah. Honestly, Prairie State could define its business purpose in a variety of ways, and I don't feel comfortable saying what would change it. I think the main point, though, is that Congress took fuel choice off, put it on the table as one of the design changes that EPA can apply here. And when it decides whether to apply it, it has to apply the statutory factors.
What about the environmental consequences of transporting this stuff from Pennsylvania, wherever it comes from?
If EPA looked at the environmental impacts as the statute tells it to, those impacts would come into play.
They're going to be very large, aren't they?
They might be, but again, we don't know.
I think they're going to be very. You know why they're going to be very large? Because in the ordinary case, when you're talking about clean fuels, there's no reason why to think that the clean fuel is farther away than the dirty fuel. But this is unique because they've located it next to the high sulfur coal precisely because of the economies of proximity. So this goes to the design issue. It is highly likely that the low sulfur coal will actually present significant environmental problems because it's going to be transported from a considerable distance, whereas the high sulfur coal is not going to be transported at all.
EPA didn't put anything in the record that suggests that its decision was based on any of that. I mean,
its decision is based on this conception that you don't have to redesign the plant. That's their basic idea. And in deciding what is redesign, one of the issues is, should this proximity of the fuel source to the plant, should this be regarded as a design factor, rather than just as an accidental choice of a fuel?
Every back condition involves a redesign of the plant. That's the whole point, is to look at the plant and see whether they're cost-effective.
You were reluctant to suggest they had to redesign it as a nuclear plant to get a really clean fuel.
No, what I said is that I think the statute leaves room to distinguish that case as a different case.
Why does it leave room to distinguish the case? You just said 1 minute ago that a design change to accommodate a clean fuel is something the EPA has to look at. Well, redesigning a plant from coal to nuclear is a design change that enables them to use a clean fuel. So why do you think it's outside the statute entirely? Or maybe you don't think that.
No, you're not. The key point here is that on this record, it's very clear that...
That's not responsive. I'm not talking about this record. I'm talking about whether you think that my nuclear hypothetical is categorically excluded by the statute from the EPA's purview.
Well, if I may answer that with regard to how...
You can answer yes or no, and then you can explain your answer. Is it categorically excluded?
Yes, I think it's categorically excluded, but may I tell you why?
What's in the statute that tells you that?
Well, I think it's categorically excluded because Congress, when it installed the term clean fuels, made very clear that it thinks that low sulfur coal is a cleaner version of high sulfur coal. That's what that term means. It's not at all clear.
Why do you say that? It just says clean fuel. It doesn't say cleaner version of the same molecules.
Right, but that term, I think, gives EPA some room to build a record saying nuclear fuel.
I'm sorry, what?
That term, clean fuels, gives EPA some room to
Why? Nuclear fuel is a clean fuel.
What I'm suggesting here is that there's an argument that EPA...
You're revising the statute, say, cleaner fuel, or cleaner...
Well, no. What I'm saying is that clean fuel admits... Clean fuel, there are ways that you can define the term clean fuel, but whatever EPA does, it has to...
Clean fuel is a fuel that has fewer pollutants than a dirty fuel.
Well, no, that's one definition, but EPA could...
definition?
EPA, I think, could say, without violating... any of the statute.
No, now you're changing your position. You said they had to say that. My question was, does the statute categorically exclude the nuclear redesign option?
Well, that's why I hesitate to give...
saying the EPA could.
That's why I hesitate to give you a categorical answer. The answer that I want to give you is, I admit, not categorical. It's that that term allows EPA enough room to distinguish nuclear fuel.
So you really think Congress left it open to the EPA to say, oh, well, sorry, we don't like coal plants. They don't have clean enough fuel for us. We want nuclear, or we want hydro, or wind.
Well, no, again...
So you're saying that's the EPA, yeah, could do that. Doesn't have to, but could interpret clean fuels that way.
I think if EPA did that, industry would have a strong argument.
What would its argument be? What would be so strong about its argument?
Because if you look at the legislative history of the statute, they would have to go to the legislative history.
I don't look at legislative history anymore.
Well, I think at that point you'd have effectively a Chevron Step 2 case.
Why don't we have it here?
Because everyone acknowledges that low-sulfur coal is an available clean fuel.
Well, nuclear fuel is available.
Well, my point is that EPA wouldn't... It's possible to build a record where everyone wouldn't agree that that's true. It's very difficult to build that record here, and in fact, that record doesn't exist.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Narayan. Mr. Lipschultz?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jack Lipschultz from the Justice Department on behalf of EPA. With me today at council table is Brian Doster from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Your Honor, this case presents two questions. On the first issue, best available control technology issue, which we've just been discussing with the petitioner, and the second issue is regarding the NAAQS impacts issue. On the BACT issue, it's uncontested that Sierra Club's main point that clean fuels like low sulfur coal are one of the production processes and available methods, systems, and techniques referenced in the BACT definition. But that uncontested point doesn't answer the question of what is the proposed facility to which BACT controls are applied. What the EAB did here was to strike a practical and reasonable balancing of these two statutory terms. It permits the permit authority's case-by-case discretion to determine which elements of a proposed facility are fundamental to its design and which can be changed as part of the BACT analysis. This sort of case-by-case approach is directly supported by the statute. In Section 165A4, for example, statute provides that it's the proposed facility that is subject to BACT. In the BACT definition itself...
I don't understand. So you can propose anything? You can propose a plant that burns charcoal or something? I don't understand.
Well, no, Your Honor. The EAB's decisions certainly made reference to certain constraints on this. For one thing, the EAB did say that the design selected has to be for reasons independent of air quality permitting. As another factor, the BACT analysis is just one component of the overall review of these permits. For instance, in the PSD program, there's something called the PSD increments for each applicable pollutant, and it has to be shown that the proposed facility will not exceed the applicable increments.
Is that the problem with the ozone as opposed to...
The ozone is yet another requirement, which you have to show that you will not cause what they call NAAQS attainment problems, National Ambient Air Quality Standards.
What would be the incremental regulation with regard to the sulfur dioxide?
Well, there's no allegation in this case that the emissions from this plant will be unacceptable in terms of sulfur dioxide increments. What the petitioners are claiming...
There is an incremental limitation?
Yes, they are defined for various pollutants, and they're applicable, and it's one of the analyses that the permit authority makes in making these permit decisions.
You mentioned ozone. Can I just ask a question? Is there modeling now for the 8-hour standard? Has that come about yet?
It's not in the record of this action, Your Honor, but I believe that there is not recommended modeling as of now.
Okay. And then let me ask you, in terms of the BAT analysis and this whole low-sulfur coal, there was really not any analysis that considered, in the BAT analysis, that considered the possibility of blending the low-sulfur coal with coal from the adjacent mine, was there?
Let me respond to it this way. During the permit process before the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, which was the permitting authority here, among other arguments, the suggestion by commenters was made that blending would be an appropriate way of perhaps of incorporating low sulfur coal. The IEPA responded to those comments. You can find that at pages 336 and 363 of the joint appendix. And a large part of what they said was simply saying that blending as an option is not really helpful because there's any number of different blending scenarios that one might think of, and without having a specific one to look at, you have endless numbers of combinations of fuel inputs and what the control technology that you would add to that would be. I'm bringing it up not because of the merits of that, but what I'm saying is that was an issue that was ventilated at the IEPA level, but it's not been pursued by the Sierra Club to this court as an argument. What the EAB decided, the issue on which the EAB decided, didn't reach that uncontested, now uncontested record issue. The EAB decided on sort of broader basis, saying that because this plant was designed to make use of the on-site source of coal, it would be a fundamental redesign not to have any scenario for the fuel source that was other than using that coal mine. I mean, they're both part of the same source. That's never been contested. The source of coal was considered to provide fuel for 30 years for the plant, etc. All those record findings have never been contested by the Sierra Club. Their entire argument to this court is a legal one, saying that low sulfur coal has to be considered a clean fuel within the BACT definition. And what the EAB said was, I think, a very reasonable response, which was, clean fuels are a process method, et cetera, referenced within the BACT definition. It says so expressly, of course, but the statute overall also talks about applying these things to the proposed facility. And so when you get to questions of whether the back analysis is going to look at options that would wholly change the proposed facility, it needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis by the permit authority here. And that's exactly what the IEP did.
Is there some literature on mine-mouth coal-generating plants? I mean, is this sort of a recognized design type, or is it something unique to Peabody?
You know, Your Honor, candidly, I can't think of anything in the record of the section that speaks to that, but
the intervener... just curiosity about the... Because we know a nuclear plant is different from a coal plant. Coal and oil plants are different, although they're very similar, actually. But I just wonder whether there's some notion of a mine-mouth coal-burning electric generator as a type of plant.
And I have to be honest, I couldn't speak more broadly than the record of this action, but Prairie State's attorney does have some time today at argument, and perhaps he would know more than I would about that. Getting back to the legal issue, I also want to make another point, which is there was some discussion in the petitioner's time about wholly separate types of facilities, such as a nuclear plant. And the EAB also addressed that issue in this case. And the way the EAB approached it, and this is a finding that's not challenged before this court by the Sierra Club, is that things that are fundamental changes like that can be looked at by the permit authority, but under a sort of a separate track, the alternatives track that's set forth in Section 165A2 of the statute. And in fact, in this case, the IEPA did that. They looked at wind plants and other kinds of alternative energy plants. And the IEPA, the EAB upheld the IEPA's determination on those issues, and that's not challenged here. I also want to briefly mention that the legislative history speaks pretty persuasively to a lot of the issues that are involved in this case. I mean, of course, it's the text that's most important, but in this case, we also have fairly authoritative sources of legislative history in the Senate reports from 1977 and 1990, in particular, in Senator Muskie's statements in 1977, and Senator Muskie was the lead sponsor of the 1977 amendments. The 1977 legislative history makes clear that Congress intended state authorities have discretion to review back analyses on a case-by-case basis with reference to the applicant's proposed design. And Senator Muskie's statement specifically noted that he believed that the back requirement would enhance the prospect for use of eastern and midwestern coal. I mean, this was arising in the context of the 1970s energy crisis, and his point was that by providing for the application on a case-by-case basis of stringent add-on controls, it would now be possible for plants to make use of local coal resources that plants had previously shied away from because of their high sulfur content. I'd like to move on to the St. Louis ozone impacts issue. And on this case, there's really no dispute about many of the underlying facts. There was no reliable 8-hour modeling techniques available at the time of the permit decision. The IEPA...
Isn't the real problem here simply that they announced this new 1-hour or 8-hour, I mean 8-hour, the new 8-hour thing, 8-hour, without implementation?
No, Your Honor.
They announce it, but they don't tell you how to show compliance with it?
There are a large set of implementation rules for the 8-hour standard, which are not at issue in this case. With regard to this particular issue, it's a modeling issue, and the.
But isn't your argument that you can't comply or that you can't prove compliance?
No, Your Honor.
Until they complete there.
It's a question of technique.
Well, maybe you could explain what the 1-hour and the 8-hour business is about.
Certainly, Your Honor. In brief, when the standard was changed, the 1-hour and 8-hour specifically refer to averaging time. So when you're talking about the 1-hour standard, in general, you're talking about monitored exceedances, or if it's a modeling exercise, modeled exceedances averaged over a 1-hour period. When you're talking about 8 hours...
How do you pick the 1 hour?
Well, there are various protocols for doing that for the 1 hour.
A sunny day or something. So they pick an app. Someone picks, and then they just monitor for an hour. They look for the.
Well, what you're basically looking for in engaging attainment is are the peak episodes. So you there are certain. I can't remember all the details, but we have it in our brief. There's a footnote in our brief that goes through this. But for the 8 hour standard, I think you look back a few years and there's a certain number of. If you have a certain number of peak episodes during those years that exceed the standard, then you're deemed to be a non-attainment. What you're looking at are peaks. And the difference is that the main difference that's important for this case is that the 8-hour standard is averaged over a longer period of time, so that when you're seeing a peak under a 1-hour standard, that doesn't necessarily mean that that reading would be the same under a longer averaging time. Because, you know, if it's, you know, 80 over a 1 hour period, but the surrounding 6 hours are 20. When you measure it over, when you average over 8 hour period, it'd be a lower.
Well, the 8 hour is it's an average. It's not looking for the highest point in the.
That's correct. It's averaged over an 8 hour period, and so in this case, when IEPA did its 1 hour ozone study, it was at the time simply looking for exceedances of the 1 hour standard, but the data, and this is explained in the record. The data also set forth exceedances of other points. The 1 hour standard is, I believe, equivalent to a concentration of something around 120 parts per billion. The 8 hour standard is a lower concentration, 80 parts per billion, but since it's averaged over a longer period of time, et cetera. The charts in the study have various plots for 120, 100, I think, 80, et cetera. This is tables 12 through 19, I believe, of the St. Louis 1 hour study, and what the IEPA found, and you can find this at pages 10 to 11 of the St. Louis study, which is on the intervener's appendix at pages 56 to 57, or the joint appendix at pages 134 to 135. Is that when you're looking at the contribution from the Prairie State plant as well as the seven other plants that were modeled as part of that exercise, the contributions that they made to St. Louis's ozone problem did not occur at the times when St. Louis was exceeding those peaks. So in other words, Sierra Club's whole argument here is that when you have an area that's designated non-attainment, like St. Louis, any contribution of any sort to an ozone problem is by definition improper. And what we are saying here is that you measure exceedances of the ozone standard by specific instances at specific locations. And what the IEPA's analysis found is that although there were some contributions from these plants, of course, because ozone is a collective problem, it was not a significant contributor to the specific episodes that gave rise to the non-attainment finding. So that, you know, so this all started when you asked me a question of has the EPA failed to specify how to implement the 8-hour standard? The answer is that EPA's regulations say because ozone modeling is so tricky, and we've discussed this in our brief, it's very hard to do single-source ozone modeling. The regulations say consult with the EPA region on a case-by-case basis. That was done here, and the EPA region said you can use the same techniques we've been using under the 1 hour. The IEPA did that, plus they went further and looked at the underlying data from the 1 hour study and drew reasonable insights into the 8-hour finding. I also just want to make one final point. I see my time is out, but on this issue, the Sierra Club never raised any of these specific technical points. Their only argument, and the interveners attached to their brief a copy of Sierra Club's petition to the EAB, and you can see it there. Their only arguments on this point to the EAB were very general. They said, you know, the statute requires an 8-hour showing. All you did was 1-hour analysis. That's not enough. They didn't even try and grapple at all with any of these details. And so what we're What we're left with here is and it didn't come up in their briefing until the reply brief, so it's a funny kind of situation. I think that they should be deemed to have waived this argument. If not, I think I've explained as best I can what the gist of the response is.
Okay,
further questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Johnson?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The impetus for the Prairie State Generating Station was...
Well, do you have any experience with these mine mouth plants? Are they common? Do you have other ones?
There are other mine mouth power plants, and as in this case, when there are mine mouth power plants, they are, in the lexicon of the Clean Air Act, permitted as a single source. That is, the mine and the power plant are given a single permit, and the emissions from both the mine and from the plant and the integrated equipment are all modeled together and all considered together. So
it's
this
a run of the mine. They take all the coal from that mine.
All the coal that is recoverable, that is, that can be burned. Yes, Your Honor. The entire impetus for this project was to build a facility where the fuel and the power plant are on the same site and they are integrated together by means of conveyor belts and other equipment. And this was a project that was conceived, as IEPA found and the EAB confirmed, not for air quality permitting reasons, but rather for the efficiencies that could be generated from using the fuel at the same place you're going to have the power plant.
Is there more, or is there a description somewhere of what more is involved besides the conveyor belt?
Yes, the permit itself goes through in some detail as to all the integrated equipment.
It's not just a conveyor belt, you're saying?
Oh, no, Your Honor. There are all sorts of various equipment that must be used for transporting the coal, for ensuring that the emissions from those pieces of equipment don't violate any of the air quality standards and that sort of thing. One of the reasons why you do this is you avoid the vagaries of transportation and market conditions. As we've seen in recent years, when there was a natural gas crunch, that created quite a problem for natural gas plants. Here we have a dedicated fuel supply that is sufficient to last for the duration of this facility. It's under common ownership.
I was going to say, it's all owned by the same.
Yes, as IEPA and EAB both found, this will be common ownership, and so you take out that variable in the ability of the plant to serve efficiently its customers. This plant, despite what Sierra Club has said to this court and in their briefs, would not exist if it were not on this particular site where the fuel is. And Your Honor's question was very appropriate, and that is, could you force Peabody or Prairie State to build a nuclear power plant or to move the plant? Well, that is the nature of the inquiry. You must have a starting point. When Prairie State conceived of this project, they start with an application under the Clean Air Act to the Illinois EPA. And they propose a facility, and that is the language that is expressly used in 165A. 165A, the proposed facility, and it is that proposed facility that must be subject to best available control technology. It is the agency's prerogative to define what does proposed facility means. And you have seen that the petitioners have taken varying positions both below and in this court. In fact, one of the headings of the brief to the EAB for the petitioners stated, and I quote, a heading in their brief, only alternatives that would abandon the fundamental purpose of the facility may be excluded from the BACT analysis. And so the debate below in the Environmental Appeals Board was, who defines and how do you define the fundamental purpose of this facility? And what EAB concluded was that the Illinois EPA had taken a hard look to ascertain what is the fundamental purpose of this facility. IEPA concluded, and EAB found that to be an entirely reasonable conclusion, that this was a mine-mouth power plant designed to use a dedicated supply of fuel. To require consideration and possible use of an alternative fuel would fundamentally change what this project was, and in fact, it would not exist. To use an example, if you think of a hydroelectric plant, where would you build that? You would build that where you have a source of water. It would make no sense to say to the applicant in that situation, you ought to consider burning coal, or you ought to consider a nuclear plant. That would fundamentally change what the applicant is trying to do with its project.
Was there a discussion of where the low sulfur coal would come from?
I believe there were some references in IEPA's responsiveness summary, that is its response to comments, that the low sulfur coal would come from out west, approximately 1,000 miles away. Yes.
On this idea of blending low sulfur coal, why would this alter the basic design of the facility?
Well, it would alter the fundamental purpose of the facility as well as the design, because first of all, again, it is designed to use 100% of the mine coal that's on site. If you started bringing in some percentage, some unknown percentage, or variable or not, from off-site, then you have to build the facilities that would take that into account. You would have to start conducting the analyses of what coal you would get, what the sulfur content would be, whether that coal would be washed or not. It would require what IEPA found to be a very, very difficult analysis.
Well, it changes your whole economic aspect too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And again, it would change the reliability and ultimately the efficiency of this plant. If you set a sulfur emission limit based on some concept of blending the coal, and that coal became unavailable for some reason, whether it's because the market had an interruption or there was a transportation problem, then essentially you would have to shut this plant down because you would then only have your mine coal and you could not meet that emission limit otherwise.
And you'd be subject to market rate, depending on the length of your coal contract at other mines.
Absolutely, and we've seen that there are market disruptions. The natural gas example is a perfect example. And if the agencies were to require in every instance that every facility use low sulfur coal as its means of meeting the BAC definition, then obviously, and IEPA pointed this out, you would have increased demand for that low sulfur coal, which is going to have market effects. Your Honor, I see my time is up. We appreciate Your Honor's attention, and we ask that the petition be denied. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Narayan, your time expired, but we'll give you a couple of minutes. Pestered you with a lot of questions.
If you may, I'd like to just answer one question about blending coal and then go on to our second claim. I just want to point out that the issue of coal blending was raised in the record. It's on Joint Appendix, page 335. And the difficult analysis that Prairie State just discussed is, in essence, the BACT analysis, looking at the market impacts and the costs and impacts of bringing in other fuels to see whether or not they make sense. It's what EPA does for every other coal plant in the country. All we're asking is that they do it here. Now, turning to our second claim, the ozone standards, our central claim here is and has always been that somewhere in this record, EPA needs some understandable showing that pollution from this plant will not contribute to ozone pollution in excess of the 8-hour standard, that is 80 parts per billion.
What would you like them to do concretely?
Run exactly the same analysis they did before, but give us some analysis that concludes that this plant will not...
I don't understand. What do you want them to do?
They can use exactly the same methodology, but ultimately the statute requires them to conclude that this plant will not contribute to ozone pollution in excess of...
Available methodology doesn't enable such a conclusion.
Well, we know, if you look at their one-hour analysis, it enables them to conclude what the ozone levels will be in St. Louis. Now, the issue between the one-hour and eight-hour might be variable, but they can say one-hour averages, eight-hour averages are the same. But the key here is that the one-hour standard is 120, and the eight-hour standard is 80, much lower. Their one-hour analysis said, even in areas of St. Louis where air pollution was at 80 parts per billion, this plant would add another 5 to 7 parts per billion of ozone to those areas. Now, that can't satisfy a statute that says before any plant can be permitted, Prairie State has to have an affirmative demonstration that impacts that there will be no impacts in addition to...
What is this modeling issue, then?
EPA is relying on its discretion over the methods of analysis, and it's true that they can use their one-hour model. I mean, what the model does is it takes nitrogen oxide levels and VOC levels and takes all those inputs and then translates them into ozone levels, and that's a complicated process. But taking every aspect of EPA's methodology as correct, what their analysis said here was that this plant would add to ozone levels in areas of St. Louis where background levels were 80 to 90 parts per billion, in other words, over the eight-hour standard. So if that's the only analysis in the record, the statute says they can't...
I don't understand you. Without a model for, as you say, translating what the nitrogen and so on, sunlight, I don't know, into ozone, you can't make a conclusion about the ozone, can you?
Well, Your Honor, they have a model for translating those emissions levels into ozone.
Well, what don't they have?
What they say they don't have is a model that addresses the 8 hours.
The EPA said it didn't have that.
Well, no, they all acknowledge they have a model that will work to give you a one-hour level. And what they're saying is you want to use our one-hour levels as a surrogate for the eight-hour levels, which is absolutely fine. That model exists. It's in the record at Joint Appendix 125. They ran the analysis. But what the analysis concluded was that background levels of ozone pollution in St. Louis would be above the eight-hour standard, above 80 parts per billion.
But I thought you said they didn't have an eight-hour model yet.
Well, yes, they don't have a model specifically designed for the eight-hour standards. What they said is we're going to use our one-hour model, the old models, as a surrogate.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that. They can do that.
Then what are you complaining about?
Well, however much discretion they have over the choice of model, they can't take an analysis that concludes one thing.
But they don't have an eight-hour model, right?
No, but they have a model that they say is adequate to provide a conclusion that will address the eight-hour standard. But the conclusion of their model isn't that ozone levels will be below the standard. In other words, they say, well, our model will give us an ozone level, and we will use that. But somewhere there has to be a demonstration that manages it. Now, the statute actually places the burden of making this demonstration on the permit applicant. So if there's no demonstration...
If there's no model, how do they make the demonstration?
Well, what they've said is we look at our one-hour model...
What are you saying? If there is no model, how do they make a demonstration?
They look at their one-hour model, and they say, what are the ozone levels in St. Louis? Are they above or below the standard? Here the model says above the standard, and it says above the standards in as a background level in the whole area. And then the model will tell you this plant will add a certain amount of ozone to those areas. Does it or does it not contribute to ozone pollution in excess of the national standard, which is 80 parts per billion? So the methodology, we're willing to take every aspect of EPA's methods and methodology and model as correct. But at the end of the day, they need something that says this plant won't contribute ozone pollution.
You still lost me. I thought there was a dispute about the fact that the EPA had not set forth, as you say, a model for the 8 hours, the 8-hour test. Am I wrong about that? There's no dispute over that?
No, there's no dispute over that. The absence of a model specifically devoted to the 8-hour test doesn't prevent EPA from reaching a conclusion as to...
You're just saying they reached the wrong conclusion?
Absolutely. There's nothing in this record, nothing, that says that
but
this...
But if they had a model for the 8-hour, might they reach a different conclusion?
They might, but what we're left with is the model in the record, which reaches exactly the wrong conclusion, that there will be contributions to ozone levels in excess of the national standard.
Are you saying we should forget about the 8 hours and just talk about the 1 hour and that they flunked the 1 hour? Is the 8 hour irrelevant because there's no model, or is it, or what?
No, the 8 hour is not irrelevant.
Why is it relevant if there's no model for it?
Well, Well, it's relevant because it's a currently applicable national standard.
Well, how can it be applicable if there's no model that permits it to be applied?
Well, no, the difference between the 8-hour and the 1-hour standard, there's two differences. One is the level.
What I didn't understand is apparently you need a model in order to figure out how much ozone you actually get from atmospheric conditions. Well, if you need a model for an 8-hour averaging test, and if there's no model, how can you apply the test?
There is a model that tells you what the ozone levels in St. Louis will be at a one-hour averaging period.
I understand how they could flunk a one-hour test. I can understand how they could flunk an 8-hour test with a model. If they flunk the 1-hour test, fine. But then you don't have to worry about the 8-hour test. I don't understand how the 8-hour test can have any relevance to this case without a model designed for the 8-hour test. That's what I don't understand.
So let me begin by saying there are two standards, both of which are currently applicable standards. The 8-hour standard, which is at 80 parts per billion, and the 1-hour standard, which is at 120 parts per billion. What the model does, I mean, leave aside for the moment whether it's designated a 1-hour model or an 8-hour model.
No, I'm not going to leave that aside, because as I understand it, the EPA wants to have an 8-hour model. It thinks that's important for some reason, and it hasn't done it yet. Isn't that right?
No, what EPA has said here is we're going to look at our 1-hour model and see what it tells us about the 8-hour levels. It's just a different... I mean, we still know what ozone levels will be in St. Louis, and we still know how much pollution this will contribute to those levels.
So are you saying the EPA just screwed up? They did the right thing. They looked at the 1 hour and looked at the 8 hours. They just made a mistake, so that the fact that they don't have an 8-hour model is irrelevant? Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. Everybody here agrees. I mean, EPA says that it's possible to look at their 1-hour model and draw a conclusion as to what's going to happen.
One conclusion, you're saying.
The conclusion in the record is not the conclusion the statute requires them to draw.
They drew the wrong conclusion.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Narayan and Mr. Lipschultz and Mr. Johnson.